Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. Well, excessive debt was a key cause of the global financial crisis, but 11 years on, world debt is much higher, leading many analysts to warn another crisis is on its way, and Australia is far more vulnerable. Where the global financial crisis was caused by corruption of the private credit markets, we are now faced with a more troubling issue, the potential failure of government, or otherwise known as public debt markets. In the fight to stave off recessions, maintain growth, protect currencies, world central banks are now finding fewer bullets remaining in the gun than ever before. Here to run through our take on the ticking debt bomb is Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And with no further ado, let's jump into today. So the agenda for today is we're going to start off with the business of fear as by topics. We're then going to be looking at government debt, unfunded liabilities, consumer debt, corporate debt, and then, of course, round out by way of investment incomes and how we use these themes, investment outcomes, and how we use these themes every day in the portfolios we run at Nucleus Wealth. So with no further ado, let's kick off with the business of fear, Damien.
Yes. So, look, I mean, the key thing, this pops up quite frequently. It's actually quite a common question we get from from investors is, you know, here's XYZ stat and it sounds really worrying and somebody says the world's about to end and what do you think? And I guess the key thing I just want to, we keep coming back to people and saying is that, you know, your eyeballs are a source of revenue to media players. Mm. If they're a newspaper, newsletter, investment newsletters, it's much more profitable to tell you that, hey, the end is nigh, then the end might be a little way away. Don't really worry about it for a couple of years yet.
Everything's fine. We'll see you in 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess that's the key one is you know, headlines are important, and as our big ticking time bomb is on this podcast alone. So, you know,
thanks for clicking.
That's right. But it does come back to that point about saying, well, what do you have to be worried about? And there are parts to be concerned about at the moment, but there are other parts that aren't of a major concern to me at all. And for every time you read that headline and click through, it's actually saying, well, what actually is it? And so debt is a promise for somebody to pay, but it's very important to know who that promise is from and who it's to. Mm. You know, I've promised my wife $1 million if I do whatever. Don't do the washing up, whatever. I default on that. There's, you know, it's all within the family. There's not, you know, I might suffer some consequences personally, but there's a
it's internalized
within that, which is very different to me. You know, having a $1 million loan to a bank or different again to a loan shark. You know, there's certain it really matters who is taking the debt out and who is who they've taken it from. So that's sure. That's a big part we'll play in as we go on. And the next part is the imminence is extremely important. Is that 50 years ago you could have run with some headlines about Australian consumer debt and about how it had doubled within a couple of years, and then a couple of years later you could say, oh, well, it's doubled again, but it doubled from very low levels, and you know, we're 50 years into that sort of debt growth.
Yep.
And the end hasn't come yet. And so it is important to take into concept is to, there are major debt issues and there are unfunded liabilities and there's other things we'll go through in this podcast. But just because we're talking about it right now doesn't mean that it's going to fall over, 20 minutes later. Some of these imbalances can last for years and decades. Mm. And so, getting a feel for how much of a problem and how imminent is that problem is pretty key as well to sort of working out how much fear should there be.
How much importance we should align to the various
absolutely.
Line items. Okay, fantastic. All right, so we'll roll into government debt.
Yeah, so I've got actually this is just some total debt to GDP ratios for some of the bigger economies. And also, you know, feel free to drop in questions. I'm sure users will have some.
Yep.
On the government debt, I'm just showing some of the biggest economies, the G7, and how so Japan, for example, we've got here 370 odd percent. US, China, both at sort of 250%. This is sort of adding up a whole bunch of different levels of debt. And so certainly a lot of the, certainly the numbers are very big. And if you start adding in some of the other numbers that aren't actually included, you can get even larger. I guess I wanted to use Japan as one of the test cases because they're a long way ahead of everyone else. They've sort of been stuck on 0% interest rates for 10, 15 years now.
Yep.
They've going through the whole demographic decline and, you know, their debt is the highest there, but it's also been building up for the longest in terms of this. And so, you know, there's been they call the, you know, the Japanese bond market is being called the widow maker in terms of everyone keeps saying, you know, the end is almost nigh, the end is nigh, the end is nigh, but the end hasn't been reached.
It just keeps
rolling on.
And it's a bit of a poster child, isn't it? The Japanese economy or the Japanese method in terms of what they've been doing in versus everybody else. And everyone's quick to put their hand up and say, you know, look at what Japan's doing. But as you say, there hasn't really been a huge sort of external issue.
No, that's right. And also, you know, employment's been quite strong there. Jobs growth's been all right. Sorry, wage growth's been all right. So, you know, a lot of it is demographics. And so while the GDP itself has had issues and, you know, very much struggling to get inflation,
yep.
It hasn't been a terrible outcome for the average Japanese citizen. And so that's where, you know, the question for a lot of people in terms of how to deal with the debt is, you know, do you come up with a Japanese solution where things are just, you know, really slow and really drawn out and very sluggish economic growth for a long, long period of time while all the imbalances work their way out of the system? Or do you go the short, sharp, quick Iceland method where huge unemployment for a year or two and then you pass it and you're back to growing normally? It's a question of you know, most politicians, if you say, would you like to deal with it now or later, will very quickly jump to let's deal with it later.
Later, yeah.
which means, you know, maybe on a 10-year view, you're better off just taking the pain and getting over with it.
Yep.
But I don't think that's the political will.
No.
Yeah. So yep. let's jump in quickly. Look at Japan.
Yeah, sure.
So I've just got sort of debt to GDP up on a chart. For anyone who's not listening, it's a pretty good 45-degree line from left to right.
And just quickly, the charts are available in there's a link in the show notes as well for those listening to the podcast, as always. Yep.
Yep. And going from in the 80s, you know, 50% debt to GDP to pretty closing in on 250% debt to GDP. This is gross government debt to GDP. And so I guess the main thing I want to come back with government debt is government debt is an issue when it's in somebody else's currency.
Okay.
If you own your own printing press, debt is not as much of an issue. And so of the categories I sort of spoke about at the start, we had the government debt and the unfunded liabilities. I don't have as much of a concern about because if you own your own printing press,
yep.
if you don't own your own printing press, there could be issues.
Yep.
As we've seen
Hello,
in
Europe.
Yeah. Elements of Europe, certainly. Or if you've got a lot of your money or a lot of it's been borrowed from overseas. So,
sure.
So Argentina and other countries like that.
Okay.
So Japan, here's Japan. So those numbers sound pretty scary. However, when you break down into some of the net debt figures, they look far less scary. So you start with your 250 debt to GDP. Then you take away and say, well, what are the financial assets that's owned by the Japanese government?
Yep.
So we want to get back to a net debt to GDP because they do have assets that are saleable and convertible. And so that sort of brings you back to 150% of GDP. So that sort of pretty quickly knocks it down a huge amount. And then you go, well, who owns this debt? So the debt, first part is netting off those. Second part is saying, well, who do you owe it to?
Yep.
And about 90% of the debt is owed to, or 90% of debt to GDP
yep.
is owed to the Central Bank of Japan, Bank of Japan.
Yep. Okay.
And so you effectively owe it to yourself.
Yeah.
So it's an arm of the government. So
it's like lending to your wife.
Exactly. Yeah. If you want to take that out, you get back to 60% of debt to GDP,
wow.
which is basically where they were, you know, in the 1980s, which obviously sounds way more reasonable. So the question for a lot of these comes back to saying, well, if the central bank wanted to monetize the debts tomorrow and say everything's wiped out, you know, except for the psyche of the people and the sovereign nation and how much he trusts the Japanese yen, everything goes on as usual.
Yep.
You know, there's no real change at the moment. It's just one arm of the government lending to the other arm of the government.
It's just a bit of accounting magic.
Absolutely. And so a lot of this is all about saying, you know, central banks and independent central banks were all about saying, well, we don't want governments to spend freely and to run up these huge inflation. You know, Weimar Republic keeps coming out.
Yep.
And so we set up this independent central bank, and they're the ones to make sure that government, we don't just print money. Governments don't just print money, and you end up in those problems.
Yep. Okay.
But the net effect is
they print money.
They are just doing that. They're just basically saying the Japanese government is going, well, we need to spend money. We need to spend stimulus money, and they're saying, okay, here you go. And so, where does the money come from? Well, effectively, it's been stolen a little bit. It's been taken from everyone.
Mm.
A lot of it's from and savers,
yep,
who have just had, you know, 0% interest rates for as long as you can,
yep,
and deflation and all these other issues. But the net effect is, if you own your own printing press, if you're a government, debt to GDP is not as much of a problem.
Mm, okay, yeah, great point.
Okay, so how do we, stepping on this, I sort of ran a focus on some Ray Dalio. We ran through his book in terms of how to deal with debt crises.
Mm.
Couple of months ago in a podcast. So it might be worth, you know, if you are interested in the whole how do you deal with debt crisis, it's worth looking at. I've grabbed a chart from there, which is basically looking at policy responses for governments. So you run into these problems of having too much debt as a government, owning your own printing press. Now the magic to getting out of the problem is printing enough money that you don't create too much inflation,
mm-hmm,
but not printing such a small amount of money, they end up in a depression, and arguably that the Japanese government hasn't been printing enough in terms of it. And it's just showing here that the US government, which has had a much better, much more active response, showing the US money growth and sort of back in the 1930s and 40s, where they threw a whole bunch of money at getting out of the Great Depression,
yep,
and then flattened it right off and pretty much stayed flat for whatever it is, 70, 80 years, and then the financial crisis hit, and again, a whole bunch of money thrown at the problem to sort of, and to stave off disaster. Whether you'd call it a success is
depends on whether you held the assets or not.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, I guess in the end, when you look at the financial crisis, you say that the central banks did all this, printed all this money and threw it all the problem, and you can argue, hey, we're still pretty much in the same situation and slow growth and all that. And you can say, yes, that is true. But on the other hand, we didn't have a depression.
Mm.
And so the question is, you know,
what would you prefer?
What would you prefer? Exactly. And so there might be better solutions, but the, so the key to this is policy responses. Now, we flick to the next one. I've got the sort of four key ways.
Yeah, sure. Just before we jump to that next slide, you haven't seen anything like this from an Australian perspective, have you? In your travels,
hasn't been as much of an issue in Australia.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yet.
Yeah, I was going to say, could you imagine perhaps that spike happening in sort of the next few years, perhaps?
Yeah.
The rate we're going with the RBA cutting and potential QE.
Yeah, I think certainly post the financial crisis, the Australia really benefited from having China doing effectively that.
Yep,
so sure. China spent bucket loads of money on infrastructure,
and we didn't have to print,
which meant that so we had to do some.
Yep.
We got in quite quick. So there's a couple of things. Firstly, we got in quite quickly with the checks to people to ease it off. And then China really got in hard, and that sort of drove the export business,
yep,
and more jobs and everything in the mining sectors. And so, that was what really, in my view, that was what really saved us. There was a government policy response.
Mm.
It just wasn't our government. It was somebody else's government, and we benefited from it.
On the coattails. Fair point. All right, so what have we got here? Four
key methods. Yeah. So this is again sort of coming back to that Dalio talking about how do you get out of one of these debt crises, and this is how you progress through your monetary policy. So you start with your interest rates and you cut your interest rates as much as you can, and but we're pretty much a zero bound, you know, in a bunch of countries around the world. US got off the zero bound, but they've just last night cut rates again, so mm-hmm, they're sort of heading back down towards that. So that's sort of your best way, but eventually you run out of ammunition there. Then you step into this quantitative easing where you start buying up the government debt and forcing longer-term interest rates down. And that is very useful at the start.
Mm-hmm.
However, the benefits start to decline as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So then now you need something else. And now you start getting to these helicopter drops, which is, and this is assuming that, you know, that it's a deeper downturn, which this is. So at that stage, there's a bunch of different ways you can do it and a bunch of different ways governments have done it over time. So they're usually giving money to the government directly and then the government spends it. So you might see, there's a lot of debt finance fiscal spending in Japan in the 1930s, the US during the World War II, US and UK in the 2000s. That was sort of the key to that. You can get some increase in debt finance fiscal spending where you're basically the central bank's printing money to cover debt payments. And that was sort of what Germany did in the 1930s. They did far too much of it, which sort of ends up into that problem. You've also got the central bank can sort of lend for stimulus projects.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this was coming back to what China was sort of doing in 2008, was sort of the central bank, rather than giving money directly to the government, sort of giving money to development banks that then go and give the money to projects.
Yeah, sure.
And so it is a and then there's other ways where you can sort of actually just not even bother issuing the debt. You can just print the money and give it to the governments.
Mm.
So which American Revolution, US Civil War, and China's got a few examples of that happening as well, where there are ways to get out of this, and that this is all about how much pain there is, and at what stage do you start actually spending this money. You can print money and give it directly to households. Japan tried a little bit of this. They sort of really just played at the edges of it. We saw it a bit in Australia. We didn't see the direct printing at these stages. This has actually been central. That was central banks giving money.
Okay.
And then, but you can, in the Great Depression, the US sort of came out and gave bonuses to veterans.
Yep.
And you have seen other cases. And then finally, the other thing you can do is you can have big write downs. So you can actually have, debt jubilees, they used to call them.
Mm.
And so that sort of gets you out of this problem. But debt jubilees aren't the way of the world at the moment. We've got enough vested interests. So yep. I guess in my mind, if there was going to be big write downs of debt and big losses taken by creditors, you would have seen that in the financial crisis. But it tended to be that everyone got bailed out.
Was enough.
That's right. Some equity holders certainly lost out, but generally speaking, the debt holders didn't.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So I think from a I think governments have also been scared off of that. So they sort of tried to do that with Lehman Brothers and froze up the financial system, and so unlikely to try that again in the near future, I think.
Okay, sure. Finally, the fiscal. Well,
that was sort of getting that whole tension between the two.
I've just got a question just dropped in here from Homer's Odyssey. Is there a long term forecast on the result of interest rate percentage drops and QE into the stability of the national financial structure? Or are policies now considered short-term answers to quick fix known risks? So is it a short-term?
I'm just trying to get the. So look, I think in terms of the stability of, we are at an unstable point, I guess, and this is a part where we've run out of the interest rates and the quantitative easing, we have run out of the interest rates. We're in the quantitative easing in some countries and not quite there in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
The question is when we get to those helicopter drops and you need to get that debt level down and you need to get the inflation rates up.
Yep.
So,
and that's a key thing, isn't it? Because the inflation, the ability to increase or create inflation just deflates your debts. So as long as you've got a strong source of inflation from somewhere, you're striking things at $100. As long as $100 is worth 10 in 10 years' time, then that isn't such a big issue.
Yeah, and as a really big picture sense in terms of financial stability is the key part, and I'll come back to this on the next one as well, is it's about output. It's not about saying, it's about saying, have you got an economy that is... got the resources and the capability to give a certain standard of living to its people.
Yeah.
And the answer pretty much around the world is yes. you know, we do have the resources, and if we get people working, you know, they can provide all these things to people living in there.
Yep.
Now it's a question about, well, the profits from that, how do they get divided up?
Mm.
And if it means that one part of the economy goes in deeply into debt and the other part makes all this money, then...
Which appears to be the case.
Appears to be the case. Then now it's a question about how do we divide it? How do we get the money back from the people who've got all the money and get it out to these other people to pay down their debts? And that's really what this is about, is how do we modify the rules of money that we've made in order to spread the wealth out? Because once we spread the wealth out, a lot of these problems go away.
Mm, okay.
And so I guess from a government's perspective, though, what I'm trying to say is that changing the rules is much easier because they own the printing press and they own the rule book, and they can sort of just sort of say, well, we're just going to add one more rule at the bottom of this, and, you know, the central bank shall not print money except if it's, you know, except if we really
need it.
Exactly. It's sort of a bit of the, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. So stability, I think we are in an unstable point. Is I guess answering that question is we're at an unstable point, and now the question is about how much instability will be needed before we move to the next step. And I think those helicopter drops, you'd need a decent amount of instability before people will actually want to try and deal with it.
And just sort of leading into that question as well was the regarding the, you know, the short-termism, I guess, essentially, that sort of seems fairly prevalent in our political structure, perhaps locally and probably even overseas. Whereas if there is a prolonged period, then, of course, you know, if it's going to go over two or three governments, the solution, well, then if it's causing pain for two or three governments prior, then you'd like to think they might, you know, somehow.
Oh, I admire your optimism. I've
got to be the optimistic one in the podcast.
Yeah, that's
like
right.
This.
But there's, look, I guess I'd point to the Greek and the Spanish solutions that were afforded to Europe, where it was like, is there a short-term or is there a long-term better answer or a short-term answer that'll get us past to the next election cycle?
Yep.
We'll take the short one. Thanks.
And just a follow-up, actually, speaking of Greeks, from Homer's again, the savers in the current financial climate, the ultimate losers, as debt jubilee and other monetary support measures assist those already in debt. And I guess only those.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep.
The answer is, it's definitely that it's financial repression at this stage. We've reduced interest rates to effectively zero to try and help the people who have got the debt.
Yep.
So is that a thing to say, well, you need to rush out and get a bunch of debt yourself? Maybe not. Maybe not at this point. There is a time to do it.
Yep.
But yeah, I think you're probably past that point at the moment.
Okay.
So let's go on to, as we get to the
roll
consumer
into it.
Ones.
So unfunded liabilities.
Yeah, so this is one. I've got a graph up here. I can't remember where I got this one from. It's got a source there, but it's this is sort of showing, and there's a bunch of them out there like this that are sort of showing that you can get to 1,000% debt to GDP if you include unfunded liabilities in terms of health and Social Security. Actually, this is a Bridgewater
Medicare's
one. Sorry.
A Bridgewater one.
Yeah, this is
a
Bridgewater one.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and I guess these are promises that have been made. And so this one's sort of titled, you know, IOUs in the US, and it's similar in lots of countries. You know, France in particular, and a lot of Europe has got these same issues. Australia less so, in that we've got the superannuation for a while.
Yep.
So whereas a lot of other countries have got the bigger pension guarantees.
Sure.
The issue is, again, this economic output is saying, okay, does the US economy have the capability to provide a decent lifestyle to people who are still working and still fund the retirement of the people who have retired?
Mm.
And the answer is yes, they do. They have the capability of it. Now it's a question of saying, have they promised a better lifestyle to the people in retirement than what they can afford based on the current rules? And you say,
sure.
Yes, they have, certainly.
Okay.
So now it's a question about going, well, are they going to change the rules?
Yep.
Or how are they going to divide that pie up?
Mm.
The pie is big enough. It's a question of how's everyone going to get a slice of it. Now, this is going to create political tension, absolutely. The problem for anyone who's young listening to this podcast is that old people like to vote, and they like to ring up and complain to their members, and they're the squeakiest wheel in the electoral system.
And they have a lot of free time.
They have a lot of free time. They want to get their entitlements. They're probably going to get their entitlements.
Sure.
So will they be as big as they expect? Look, they're probably going to have to be some. They're probably going to have to wind back on it and reduce it. But does the economy have the capability to fund these people in retirement? Yes, it does. Are those people voters? Yes, they are voters and quite active ones. Mm. And so while unfunded liabilities is an issue in certain elements and certain there's certain parts of the economy where it is concerned, but I think as a total, I expect that'll be solved by the next group of people coming in paying higher taxes to fund the retirement of, future, of others and maybe that retirement of people who that might not be as good as they expected.
Well, in a way, isn't that sort of, and touching on that prior question, obviously this race to the bottom in terms of rates and returns on, interest on term deposits and all that, in a way, isn't that, it's reflecting back on people who need that money are typically retirees and all the rest of it. So is there a little bit of a, auto-stabiliser in the fact that, with an overbearing debt problem at one end of the age spectrum, for example, if we're just going to look at, a personal situation, it's sort of giving a haircut, perhaps, as it were, to the top end?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that, as we spoke, we're punishing savers to help the debt.
Yeah.
The debt holders, because for a large part, the debt holders are younger and the savers are older.
Mm.
And so you're sort of saying, well, you're taking away from a bunch. You're taking away the interest rates that the older people could have earned.
Yep.
And then redistributing back to other older people who couldn't afford their retirement in a way. But I think there's the unfunded liabilities. The numbers are massive.
Yep.
They're huge. They've only got bigger over time. Mm. But interest rates are very low. And there's a question about how it can be solved. And the other thing is, if you can get some inflation going, that helps some of these as well, because then you start getting the growth and you start seeing, people don't worry as much about their money when they can see it growing. Yep. Even if on a real basis, it might be going backwards. But if they're sort of getting 1% growth a year in their savings,
they're not dipping too much into capital,
and inflation's 3%, then they're going backwards. But I think for a lot of people, that feels better. Because they still see themselves going forward and earning interest on their account than if they're sort of the other way around.
Okay, sure.
Anyway, let's jump into consumers.
Consumer debt. Okay, so historically high here. We've got a chart from LF Economics, Australian chart here.
Yeah, so just making the point that consumer debt is high historically. So I've got like a 200-year graph or something here, going back to sort of showing that consumer debt to GDP has sort of been, I don't know, maybe 25% back in the 1800s and working its way up to a little bit over 50 before sort of spending most of the 1900s in that sort of 25%-ish range. And now we're at over 150%.
Mm.
So in a view of a long term, it's high. Okay. And so, and that's not just focused on Australia. We've got another chart there, which is just sort of, again, you don't really need to see it, but it's from top left to bottom. Sorry, bottom left to top right again.
Yep.
The amount of debt, consumer debt around the world is growing dramatically. Mm. Now, this can be a problem because if you own your own printing press at home, you're sort of at the
You're living dangerously.
You're living dangerously, absolutely. And yes, you're probably not going to be able to print as much money as you want.
Yeah.
And what this caused an issue for is you need, if you've got lots of debt, you need some inflation to inflate that away.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, you need wage inflation.
Mm.
And that's what we're not getting at the moment.
Yep.
And it's a bit of a mixture of the problem of people have so much debt that they don't want to go out and spend. And you're getting these inequalities so that we've spoken before about, $1,000 to Australia's richest person gets thrown on the pole and not spent. Australian $1,000 to Australia's poorest person gets spent in the next 20 minutes.
They spend $1,200.
Exactly. So that inequality is causing part of that problem, and that's the build-up. You can get away from that inequality for a while because if you let the people keep borrowing to fund their lifestyle, but it does reach a limit, and we're getting close to those limits. And what that means is that consumer-driven growth is slow, and only expected to be slow until we actually see some decent wage growth. It doesn't have to be real wage growth as long as nominal wage growth.
That's right. Yep.
That you're going to still see this as being a demand problem, sort of hanging over society. And so, so not only Australia, it's pretty much a global problem.
Mm, okay. Yep, sure.
So that's the consumer side. Could be, there's probably not an imminent issue on the consumer side. You can get parts where you reach, you can have high housing crises in countries, say, places like Australia or Canada that happen to be particularly over leveraged. You can get that creating the issue. And they're probably, that is an issue with those countries. But broadly speaking, this consumer debt can build up for long periods of time without actually becoming a massive, imminent issue. So in terms of imminence, unless you sort of see housing crashes, then you're not talking about it. It's more of a slow grind problem than a...
I was just going to say that. Issue. Yeah, that sounds exactly right. Okay, sure. So we'll shift over now to corporate debt.
Yeah, corporate debt. So corporate debt has a similar type of... It goes through cycles, and I've got a chart up here showing the proportion of GDP and trillions of US dollars debt. So it sort of oscillates between sort of 48% or something like that in terms of the level. So, or certainly that's what it's done over the last sort of 20, 30 years. And so you do go through these cycles where companies will borrow lots, and then you'll go through cycles where they deleverage and up again. And we have gone through a big leveraging up. Yep. So we're at, I don't know, 30-year highs for corporate debt to GDP. The levels are significant. And what that means for economically is that your margin for error starts to shrink. Mm-hmm. Is saying they do have more scope now because interest rates are so much lower. So the actual cash going out the door in terms of interest payments is a lot lower. But
they can lever up. So it means they can lever up even higher though, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. And so what it means is you get... There's a few different issues. Well, one is probably the first issue is this is exactly what the central bank's trying to do. Mm. So it might be an issue, but we know it's an issue, and the central banks were trying to get it there. They were lowering government bond rates so that people would borrow, would give money to risky ventures.
Yep, sure.
Like that was the whole plan behind the lower interest rates and the quantitative easing.
Yep.
So we've got what we wanted.
But it's not working.
It's not, yeah. It hasn't fixed the problem, no. But so we've got what central banks wanted anyway in terms. So the issue, though, is that it does create some zombie companies. Mm-hmm. So you do get companies that probably should have gone bust, but because interest rates are so low, they can just afford to hang around.
Yeah, okay.
So that does, and that puts a dampener on growth as well.
Yep.
So we've seen that certainly in Japan. That was very much an issue in Japan where central bank backed all these companies that should have gone bust, and that sort of helped to make that really anemic recovery in terms of Japan, because there's just all these companies with these massive debt overburdens just sort of sitting there, not doing any expenditure, just grinding away, paying down debt.
Yep. Okay.
So what it does mean as well is the potential for accidents to happen. So a big company that gets its numbers wrong, and even with low interest rates, has to default.
Mm.
Can then have a ripple effect, and you sort of get these domino effects where, let's say it was a company like a GE or something like that, that's sort of one that people quite often posit as the source of the next downturn.
Okay.
A company like that where big enough that when it goes under, a whole bunch of people lose a lot of money, there's heaps and heaps of headlines, all of a sudden everyone says, oh, just a minute, corporate debt is really risky, I need to pull my money out of corporate debt. All these other companies now can't roll over their existing debts, and they start to fail, and you sort of get these domino effects.
Yep.
So this is certainly an area that could be an issue, and could be imminent in terms of imminence. You know, it could be in the next couple of years.
Mm.
It's hard to say when, but typically that's you have some sort of trigger. The question is when that trigger can happen, and could it take 5 years? Could take 5 years? Could it take? You know, could it happen to take 5 days? It could take 5 days. So, but I guess the message is there is this margin for error that's shrinking because of the amount of debt that's out there.
And so we've got obviously the chart here is a US-based one. Is this sort of a similar issue on local soil? Do Australian corporate debt levels sort of sit in the same sort of category?
Yep, they're certainly high. I think in the US it's also, I've got another chart which is important to note as well, is the distribution of the debt. And this is where you'll also see a lot of you get a lot of commentary around this, which is basically that most of the debt sits in what they call triple B debt, which is basically just above investment grade.
Okay.
So you go through these lines where you can have triple A companies to give money to, so something like an Apple or someone like that who's actually got net cash and all these other securities behind it. And you say, well, if I give them, if I lend them $100, I'm pretty sure I'm getting that money back.
You're just borrowing it for tax reasons a lot of the time.
Pretty much, yeah. And then you start going down and go, okay, now you've got a double A company. So maybe the Australian banks sort of fall into that category, and then your single A's, which are your higher quality industrials and companies you're pretty sure you're going to get your money back.
Yep.
Triple B's starting to get to the stage where you're like, look, I'm still pretty sure I'm getting my money back, but I've got a twinge of doubt. And then so the dividing line from there goes, okay, well, anyone below that is then treated as what they call junk or high yield debt.
Yep, okay.
And so that's where, you get to the possibility of default is now getting quite high.
Okay.
And, the question about will you get money back or not.
And henceforth, you're demanding a much higher rate of return on that as well. So
yeah.
It increases the risk that
absolutely.
It could go bang.
And so the argument is there's $3 trillion, in the US anyway, there's $3 trillion of this triple B debt out there. And there's only about $1 trillion of the high yield debt.
Mm.
And heaps of, there's a lot of investors that aren't allowed to own high yield debt just within their mandate.
Yep.
So if a GE flicks from being triple B one day to double B the next day, all of a sudden there's all this forced sellers who just have to sell it. They're not allowed to. And so then all the prices blow out and it becomes an issue for everyone.
And I think it was mentioned in a video we watched where that, you know, if you have $1 trillion of debt move into a $1 trillion market, it's just not going to work.
No, there's certainly, it's going to affect the price of debt. And it's not as much of an issue. Well, I mean, look, there's an issue of the losses that get taken, obviously, by the companies that do it, that have moved into those. But the bigger issue is, from a macro point of view, is can other companies then borrow at the rates that are attractive enough?
Mm.
And so, and keep in mind, part of this growth is because in debt is because interest rates are so low. There's companies out there that probably should have had equity.
Yep.
But if 10 years ago. Longer than that, 15 years ago in a more normal economic circumstance, if they turned up to borrow some money, people would sort of look at them and go, well, yeah, I'll give you some money, but I need a 15% return or a 12% return.
Yep.
And they would have gone, oh, that's fine. I'll go get equity instead.
Yep. Okay.
Whereas they've been showing up saying, and they're going like, I don't really like you, but I'm really looking for yield because the Fed's squashed prices on interest rates so low.
Yep.
I'll give it to you for 7%.
Yeah, right.
And so, and they're the ones where all of a sudden they've lost their funding and they've got to turn around and find other sources of it. And so that's where, the economic instability and the dominoes can start falling.
Okay.
In terms of those markets. So your big areas of concern within that that triple B at the moment are, the thing is, a lot of it's banks, which is a plus and a minus. A plus in terms of they're probably more likely to see, if you do get some wholesale bank downgrades, you're probably more likely to see some federal, some central bank intervention into that market. So that's sort of, that sits at one end. But the flip side is, a lot of these banks are at that stage because the yield curves are now so flat and they're forced, the central banks have forced the interest rates so low that banks just aren't making money anymore.
Mm.
And so they've ended up there because of what's been happening.
Because of the very nature of what's been happening at central banks.
At central bank level, you've ended up pushing all these banks into this because the banks just aren't making any money.
There's no margin, yep.
And so, so that's a little bit, there's some big telecommunications companies, AT&T and Verizon, have sort of been pushed into there. So they're sort of just very leveraged and over debt. So, and a bunch of utilities, which are probably more likely to be able to afford it. But, they're probably key sectors. A lot gets spoken about the high yield oil stocks in the US in particular, which is one.
So this is shale.
Which is one source where there could easily be an accident.
Okay.
That's not that big as a total of the market.
Mm.
So the question would be more if you saw you did see the oil price take a huge tumble and bankruptcies within that, would that flow on to the rest of the economy or could the rest of the economy get passed? And so I think from the sort of shock we saw a couple of years ago as oil price fell, it looked like it flowed a little bit through the rest of the high yield market, but not that much.
Okay.
And so, So I guess the key thing coming back to on this corporate debt is it's a vulnerability. There could be an accident, and it's probably it's much more likely, in my view, that if you do get some sort of debt crisis, it'll come out of some large failures in a particular sectors or companies that sort of blow out the rest of the debt market.
Mm.
The yields, rather than from a government that can print its own money, like a US government or a Japanese government or a UK government.
Yep, sure.
Causing the next issue.
Okay. Yep. Sure. Nice summary. So finishing up, so we're looking at the investment implications. Got a handful of points here.
Yeah. So government debt. It's an issue if it's denominated in different currencies. Otherwise, not that concerned about it. In terms of the corporate side, I think it's not the time to be owning stocks with lots of debt. And it's probably similar to the question we had about saying, you know, a saver's being punished or not. There are stocks out there who had lots of debt who have benefited greatly as interest rates have fallen. And that's been very good for their stock prices and you know, they've been afforded to do more. Now's getting to the time where you want to be tipping out of those ones and looking for a bit more safety.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a time to own stocks with lots of debt, but I don't think now's the right time.
Yep, okay.
Because of the consumer debt, we're not expecting any rapid rise back in inflation. So maybe if you see some astronomical amounts of money printing from central banks, but we're a long way from that at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of talk about modern monetary theory or MMT. We'll leave that as a whole different discussion, but I guess the question of saying, you know, will central banks start printing and governments start causing all this inflation? Yeah, maybe, but we're a long way from that. And that's my next point, was that Weimar Germany is also a very long way away. And that it's sort of similar in that whole I've got some teenage kids and your girlfriend, boyfriend, they're starting to hold hands. Oh, no, there's going to be an unwanted pregnancy.
Yep.
And you're sort of like, well, holding hands is a long way away from a...
Yeah, right.
It might be one step in the path.
Even in today's modern age.
Yeah, that's right. But, and it's the way money printing to me is very much treated. Yep. Is saying, hey, there's a country that's holding hands, you know? Yep. Oh, no, the unwanted pregnancy is just around the corner.
Yeah, sure.
And so it's going, well...
Zimbabwe.
Yeah, that's right. So we've got two big cases of printing money where it caused major issues,
yep.
But they also have a number of...
it goes back to that. Because from memory, they had the foreign debt. Like Zimbabwe had a lot of USD denominated foreign debt was the other big issue, wasn't it?
And
going back to your first point.
Yeah, that's right. And Germany did as well.
Yeah.
Was paying war reparations and had all these foreign liabilities. So, yeah. So, I guess inflation is not our problem at the moment. Where I'm coming to with all this is that if we can get some inflation, that would be a great thing for all these debt holders, because it actually inflated away their problem. But at the moment, we've got the opposite. We've got low inflation and people sitting on these big, massive debt burdens.
And whilst you should be careful what you wish for, I think there's plenty of people out there that entertain the thought of taking a wheelbarrow load of cash down to their local bank to pay off their mortgage. But maybe it stops after that. So, fair enough.
And then because all these assets are so elevated, we're in this low return environment where it's hard to see where you're going to get a lot of the growth from, and it does mean you're going to need to be more active in your asset allocation in terms of switching between cash and bonds and shares, because finding the least dirty shirt in the laundry is important in terms of trying to eke out some returns in a lower return environment.
Okay, fantastic. We'll finish up on that note. Thanks very much, Damien, and thank you very much to Matt, who's a listener of ours, for providing some insight and some offering up today's topic as well, which is fantastic. Anybody else who's listening in who has a topic they'd like us to jump into, feel free to be in touch. Coming up next week, so on Thursday the 26th, same bat time, same bat channel, 12:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, we'll be chatting with Patrick Polk, and we'll be discussing exactly what we finished on today, the investing in the end of cycle. So really looking forward to chatting with Patrick during the week next week, and that'll be coming to you not live, so that one will be a pre-record, but look forward to putting that one out then. On that note, well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.